Well, if we pick up in basically 79 when we moved the Addiction Research Center from Lexington, Kentucky to Baltimore, Maryland.
When did you stop doing studies at the in Lexington, do you think?
I think the last study, I think, Jasinski knows this for, but I believe it was 1976 that the last prisoner was transferred from ARC to another prison facility. And I think it was done on December the 31st, 1976, because I think that's when it had to be done. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
So what did you do so between 1976 and 1979?
Tried to reestablish, tried to do those things like alcohol studies, other things, but it was a slow time around there, and some people, I don't know the personnel histories at the time, but there was people that were leaving, and it wasn't a good time in the sense of morale.
Yeah.
And people recognizing that, you know, if we weren't successful in reestablishing it there, their jobs were going to be lost, and so I would say certainly from the human's perspective, the workload productivity dropped, but the animal facility was still going on full fledged. Mm-hmm. There was an animal facility there too, so that didn't stop. And I wasn't making administrative decisions then or a part of the administration, so you know I would presume that they were probably pushing more resources over towards the animal unit.
Did you do anything with the animal stuff?
So well, I mean, and the pharmacy made medications for
that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So some of that was coming from you guys, from within.
Yeah. And so when it was finally recognized, you know, so it took a, you know, I would say it was probably decided in 78. It was decided in 78 where we're going to move to, but then you've got to get the building, you've got to get all the contracts in place, and you've got to get everything designed. So, you know, I think I probably knew in January of 79 or late fall of 78 that I would be moving. No. I probably even knew the summer of 78, because the reason why I say that is I was a public health service officer, and I had an inguinal hernia operation, and I was going to have it done in Lexington. When the public health service found out about it, it was elective surgery. I couldn't have it in Lexington. I had to go to a public health service hospital, and there was one in Baltimore. So I knew I was going to be moving to Baltimore in a year. So I chose to go there so I could put some house hunting days, because there's no such thing as house hunting days in the U.S. Public Health Service.
Yes. I wanted to ask you just about this, the isolated hardship medal in 78. What was that for?
Oh, that was for the Indian, being on the Indian reservation for 3 years.
That was pre.
That came through later, but that's what it was. That was what it was.
Okay, I was just.
Yeah, Lexington wouldn't consider a hardship.
I didn't think so.
Yeah.
But sometimes people describe it as pretty isolated. So.
Well, it was. I mean, you know, most people in Lexington didn't know it existed, I don't think. So we did know at least a year in advance, because I remember. The reason how I can remember that is that I was actually, I had to stay in the hospital during my birthday, and that's in July. So I know. I also had to stay in the hospital for 10 days for an inguinal surgery that now would be done as outpatient.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had one of those.
Yeah.
They sent me home right away.
Yeah.
So the move, mm-hmm. What are you doing once you get to Baltimore?
Well, once we get to Baltimore, we had to establish the place administratively. We had to look for, we had to do a lot of things under contract, because there was only three of us that went up. So we had to develop contracts, and those contracts had to be put in place for services like laboratory services we got from the hospital. That's why we were there on a campus. And basically what we tried to do is kind of mimic the OARC in Lexington, where the main hospital was next to us. Now we looked at Baltimore City Hospital as being the old part, and now we're a subunit sitting over the side, which was the ARC. Now we're a subunit, which is over in D building, the Mason F. Lord building. So, you always use past experiences for future decisions, and that's the parallel I see anyway.
Yeah.
And that's where I first really started getting into any administration within the ARC. Because I went there, and so Don and Al Haynes and Edie Crowder and myself, and Chuck Hartson. And the first thing we had to do, because as always with contractors, they were delayed, but so when we came in on July the 4th, there was four or five of us that had to, because we hired a person to as an administrative assistant, so we had two basic office spaces. were in one little room where Al Haynes, who was a research assistant, myself, the administrative assistant, Don Jasinski, and Edie Crowder. So we had five people in two little office areas. And Chuck Hartson was a livid cigar smoker, and there was no, and at that time you could still smoke at, in the workplace. And so we basically put him over in the room by himself and, and gave, and the rest of us sat in the other office. And then we brought in an administrative officer, Tom Bosco came in at the time. So it was starting to build up the administrative structure, and at the same time then we had to start looking at nursing staff and hiring a head nurse and then taking the head nurse. And we had to train people then also in monitoring because we used the nurses as basically as research assistants in getting questionnaires and things answered.
What was your relationship like with NIDA?
Don Jasinski can speak better to that, because I was actually between the minister. My perception from it was it that Frank Fraser or Abe Wichter, whichever one told me, was right. Because it started to look to me like people at NIDA were trying to really control the ARC and influence a lot of things that I wasn't always sure that they should be influencing.
And so,
but I was on the periphery of that.
So how did that show up? I mean, how did it...
Showed up in things like... I try to get things done. I was always, I think, a person that people would call. Maybe this should be off record right now to decide how you want to, because this gets down to individuals. One of my responsibilities, for example, as the clinical administrator, or clinical director, I don't even remember what the title was to set up recreational activities for the people who were participating, because they came in and stayed for long periods of time. We had nothing. And the government was supposed to have a impress funds cash, but the government says also you're supposed to have a room with a locked door and all this kind of stuff. So the funds had never gotten set up the way they were supposed to be set up. But I already had subjects. So I went out, for example, and bought, I think, $100 worth of puzzles and things like that. An administrative officer who'd been put over there to us basically from NIDA came in and told me that I procured without authorization, and that I better never do it again. And Jasinski signed over him; it'd be the last time Jasinski ever did. And here was the administrative officer telling me that the director, that he, and so I didn't have a lot of. And another thing happened: Don left for Geneva one time, and about 5 minutes after his plane took off, I guess I got a call from NIDA wanting to know how many subjects we had on the ward. I mean, it was almost like micromanaging or looking, and I don't know all the politics that were going on. I was just starting to learn politics, but there were politics. I can honestly say that now, that there had to be politics going on. And I always thought that it was people from there wanting the job in the ARC. That's what I thought.
Oh, that they wanted to be...
And now it was close enough they could take it. They never wanted to move to Lexington, because they wanted to... That's my view.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, so did you have the sense that... And who, NIDA? I mean, as high as the director?
No.
Or more?
No, more between Don, the boss, and then there was the director.
Yes, okay. And so did you have the sense that they had the same sort of respect the ARC?
No, I had a sense that, some of the things when you talk about ethics in the prison research, that this was a time of evolution, and some of that fell over to people who didn't understand it and never been there. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of painted with a stroke of, you're the prisoner guys, you're the guys that...
Some dissociation almost.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'll give you, I guess another example is that, the administrative officer wanted me to put up these posters on the ward, that a person came in where they're developing through treatment, And it's an honorable thing, but most of these people weren't there for treatment.
Yes.
And I think you're always better to be focused. Once you lose your focus, then you don't know who you really are. And the staff doesn't know who to follow. They don't know what to do. And then you get split in staff. Because mm-hmm. they think, one thinks you... And I always told my study participants when I was running protocols, you're in treatment research, you're not in treatment. Because if you're in treatment alone, I would individualize, but you're following a protocol.
Yeah.
That means there's limits to what can and can't be done.
Yeah.
And my attitude was, that I tried to follow was, in my own ethics was, if I knew what I knew about my own study, and I was a volunteer, would I be willing to volunteer? As long as I could say yes, that was yeah. my code of ethics.
Yeah.
Now that wouldn't be the same code of ethics for everybody, but that was my own internal.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has to have their own internal standard.
How much was that split between research and treatment articulated in studies? I mean, you're saying you told your subjects that. Was that a no?
Well, none of our studies at that time were really treatment studies.
Right.
I did treatment studies after we got larger, because what I asked for, and in fact, before I started this, I asked the new director at that time, who came in 1984, who was Jerry Jaffe, I asked Jerry Jaffe for particular resources to be able to set up a treatment unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I saw the methadone 20, methadone 60, buprenorphine 8 clinical trial as a treatment study. Those people were seeking treatment.
Right, right.
Other people were not seeking treatment, and they either were former drug dependent or were dependent at the time and qualified for a study, but they still, they might be seeking abstinence, and the study protocol may have been abstinence. But again, I did not consider that the same as treatment. I didn't even consider the treatment unit the same as community treatment, because it's being driven by research protocol. It's not being driven, and the focus was on research, not on treatment.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you know Jaffe before?
No.
So you met him when he
I knew
took
of
that
him
job
before, but I met him when he took the job.
84.
Yeah.
Right. And okay. So from 79 to 84.
To
84. You're doing this stuff.
Well, what we're doing there is we brought Jack Henningfield on from Hopkins as actually a first fellow that we had in Baltimore. He later became staff. Scott Lucas came over. We had several people rotate through. And Jasinski and I continued to work with buprenorphine, trying to develop. First, we looked at oral buprenorphine versus subcutaneous buprenorphine. And then we gave doses like 10, 20, and 40
milligrams. Were you pretty fixated on buprenorphine? I mean, were you pretty convinced? You were
champion
of it in a
yes.
way.
And Jasinski once told me that I should get out of buprenorphine because I'm going to become known as a one-drug person. One-drug researcher. And I probably am, you know. I mean, I did some research with marijuana. I did some but the majority of my, somebody told me I had 75 couple of publications in buprenorphine. I don't know if that's true or not, but
it's close to it.
And one of the papers I'm the most proud of is a monograph that was published in, I think, 1990 or 1991, and it talks about buprenorphine and development for the treatment of opiate addiction. And I like to think, that I helped push that forward and kept it on the burner, mm-hmm. you know, and it was a slow process. But I always wanted, after I decided that I wanted to go in, that I wanted to be a researcher and I wanted to do clinical research, I didn't want to do it just for, I have my own ego. I'm not going to say I don't have an ego. I always wanted to be first. If it was something that I could do that could be first, if I play a ball game, I want to win. Anything I do, I want to do it the best I can. And if there's competition, I want to be the leader of it. And there are always, in science, there is some competition
yes.
within your own groups, which is healthy competition. It's
mm-hmm.
not... And I motivated the staff with that healthy competition, saying we want to do it the best and the quickest, you know. And so anyway, in that paper, you know, I put it around the ARC, but I think that paper also is a monograph, which has probably never been read by more than maybe five or six people, and two of those are the authors. But I think it laid out. I think if people would read that, looking where we are, they would see that there was a systematic process that we were going by mm-hmm. in trying to develop buprenorphine, and I had an interest in seeing that going all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Don certainly had an interest in it, but like I said, you know, as being a director, he had to have a more diversified approach, and I focused on that,
mm-hmm.
and it's. To me, it's kind of like a dream come true. I tell people that I first started working with buprenorphine when my son entered elementary school, and it was approved for the treatment of opioid dependence when his daughter, my granddaughter, entered elementary school.
Wow, that's quite.
So I tell people, I tell people, I said, you either think I'm the most stupid person in the world or the most persistent person in the world.
Yes.
But yeah. So Don and I try to develop things, and even, you know, systematically, like, could we give it orally? We found we couldn't because we knew it was a first pass effect, but how much would you have to give orally? Then we came up with studies with relative potency estimates between sublingual, sub-Q. Don had done his study with sub-Q. He never wanted to use the sub-Q as an injectable to treat. You want to get away from needles because of the conditioning issues. Mm-hmm. If you're using needles, you don't want to, that's why methadone, one reason, it's orally effective, so you can move away from needles and decondition the person from the conditional response to the needle. Once we knew we couldn't give it orally, we went through things like, I remember John Lewis, who was actually the chemist who helped develop the medication and worked for Reckitt Coleman at the time. I mean, he brought things into my pharmacy, and we looked at them. We came up with oral preparations that would solidify. You know, if you didn't drink them in 2 minutes, it'd be so hard. It'd be so hard you couldn't get it out of. I never knew for sure what it was going to do internally, but
yeah, <really. laughs>
but we looked at different, trying to figure out different formulations that might orally. We didn't look at them very strongly, but because we figured none of them were going to work.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
we gave it thought, and. Yeah. And so what we realized was, then let's go sublingual, because we have a sublingual tablet already in Europe as an analgesic. We know that it's sublingual. Now, the problem was the sublingual tablet was too low in dose, and Reckitt Benckiser, or Reckitt Coleman at the time, was not interested in developing it for the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So we got the pure powder. We got the pure powder and would make up the formulations. And like I said earlier, at that time, you know, Don and I were going up to 2 milligrams. Well, we actually did a study with Bickel and the Hopkins. This is where the collaboration with Hopkins started. And basically, Hopkins came to us because there was only a couple of places that had an IND to be able to use buprenorphine, and one was at Yale with Tom Costa and Herb Cleaver, and the other was me and Don Jasinski, and Hopkins didn't have it. So they wanted the collaboration for that. I said, I'm willing to give that, but I won't just be a paper part of the study. I want to be a full consultant and collaborator in the study.
Yeah.
So we did a study of withdrawal using 2 milligrams of sublingual buprenorphine solution against 30 milligrams of methadone. And the first author on that paper is Bickel. He was a staff, he's president of CPD now. He was a fellow, a postdoctoral fellow at Hopkins at the time. And we did that study. And in that study, I don't remember the exact number of days that we withdrew, it was over weeks. But during the study, we did a hydromorphone challenge to look at the blockade while these people were still stable. And actually, 30 milligrams of methadone blocked the hydromorphone challenge greater than 2 milligrams of buprenorphine. And Warren Bickel can attest to this. I looked at that and I said, Warren, if this is going to ever be good for anything besides detoxification, which I now call medical withdrawal because I want to medicalize this condition, and we got to change terminology. Because detox, I will acknowledge that you detox people from street drugs because street drugs are not pure pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
But I use myself for example. I'm on a beta blocker. You have a withdrawal response if you suddenly stop beta blockers, similar to what you do with steroids. You don't stop somebody on steroids abruptly. You taper them because the body has a physiological response. That's what it is in opiate addiction. So we medically withdraw those people. I never heard a person being detoxed from steroids, and now I've heard a person are being detoxed from a beta blocker.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're medically withdrawn, and that's what we do in opioid dependence treatment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, looking at that, I said, you know, if we're going to do this, if it's going to be good for anything else besides just medical withdrawal, it's got to have better blockade in that. Because the idea with blockade is cessation. So if you try to use, you get the reinforcing effects blocked, so that behavior is extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea. And so Warren and I came up with the design, and we both, I was outside of the Hopkins, he was inside of the Hopkins, but it was actually either George or Maxine, George Bigelow or Maxine Stitcher's grant that we were working off of, coming from NIDA. And so we had to do a little coaxing to convince them that we should do a study looking at 2, 4, 8, and 16 milligrams of buprenorphine. And it took a little convincing, but we finally were able to do it. And we took, I think it was 7 subjects, and we maintained them on 2 milligrams for 2 weeks, then 4 milligrams for 2 weeks, 8 milligrams for 2 weeks, and 16 milligrams for 2 weeks. And between the day 11 and 14, somewhere between day 11 and 14, we did another hydromorphone challenge. And this time we used cumulative dosing. We used a placebo, which was a little bit different than the study I was telling you about with the 2 and the 30. We used a placebo, 6 milligrams of hydromorphone, and then 12 milligrams. And that was, they were all given an hour and a half apart, and it was cumulative. So within 3 hours, you'd given, within an hour and a half, you'd given 18 milligrams of hydromorphone. It was given an hour and a half later, you gave another one. So within that hour and a half, you'd given 18 milligrams. And that's equivalent to about 100, if you go with 7 to 1 relative potency, that's equivalent to about 125 to 150 milligrams of morphine. And that's equivalent to about 75 milligrams of heroin, which is a darn good heroin dose. Mm-hmm. And what we showed with that was, as we increased the dose of buprenorphine, the curve, response curve from placebo, like if your y-axis here is high, how high are you, how much do you feel the drug, okay? And this is 2 milligrams. This is placebo down here. This is the 6, and then this is 12, okay? Now we gave you 4. 2 weeks later, we challenged the same person. The slope of this curve continued to go down. And as it goes down, that means you're getting more blockade with the dose of buprenorphine. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you got down to 8 milligrams, you had a curve of something similar to this, maybe 10 or 15. If you put it on an angle basis, maybe it was 20 degrees or, you know, something like that. You still get some effect at those high doses because you can break through, because it's not just like everything just sitting on a receptor and not moving, so it can jump in there. But when I got to the 16 milligram, you probably, if let's just say arbitrarily that slope was, you know, at 15 degrees, we got down to 10 degrees. We didn't get much out of that. We could see a difference, but we didn't get much more out of 16. But we got a heck of a lot between 8 and 2, okay? Mm-hmm. This was 2, and this is 8, and here's 16, okay? What I decided from that was, taking that study, I decided I'm not going to use 16 for the first clinical trial. I'm going to use 8, because by doubling the dose, I run the risk of increasing the adverse side effects. And I'm going to get almost as much clinical utility out of the 8. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's how the 8 milligram dose was first determined. And it's very interesting today. That was done with solution. We think today that the bioavailability of the tablet to solution is about 50%. It varies anywhere from 30 to 70%, and maybe 80%. And it actually may get closer to 100 with chronic administration. But we used 8, and right today we think most people can be controlled on the tablet with 12 to 16 milligrams, which continues to work. Even though we only started out with 7 subjects, Jasinski only had 5 subjects in his original study, and only 3 of them finished. Mm-hmm. We did that one, which I think is, and I tell Warren this, I think that in the development of buprenorphine, that was a pivotal study, because that was what doses we started to develop for clinical mm-hmm. use. And then, so they did that study, and then people like Sharon Walsh and others started doing higher doses, even in the 16, and she went to 32. But all of that was done at the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Center. And that's where I went after I left the government. So
you left there in
1991. Okay. And published the JAMA paper in 1992.
Right. Okay. Now, LAM was somewhere in...
Yes, LAM was approved by the FDA in 1993. Okay.
So after you've left.
Yeah, after I left, and I had been a medical reviewer at the FDA my last year and a half at the ARC.
So why did you leave?
Why did I leave? You want to go off the record again?
Sure.
The directorship changed, and I was told that I could no longer do research unless I... people said I had an appearance of conflict of interest because I controlled resources and was doing research, which I find funny now that NIH requires any branch chief to also do research. I was a branch chief, and I was told that I had to get my resources from Jack Henningfield, who I trained as a postdoctoral fellow, or from another individual who had just come into the ARC. And
so what was going on there? I mean,
well, Jerry Jaffe was removed as, right. Well, I shouldn't say removed.
Yeah.
Have you heard that before?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Basically, I mean, it was an administrative decision made that he even moved down to CSAT. Mm-hmm. And again, this is off the record. I didn't realize that I was perceived as having as much power as I supposedly had. As the branch chief for the research support branch, a lot of people looked at me as the deputy director, and we had a deputy director. Mm-hmm. I didn't see myself as deputy director.
Yeah, I see.
And there was division within, and more on the deputy director's side than they were on, and that's how the move came about. I mean, I'm being very candid and honest. I hope you
keep it off the record.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just have, I mean, I've been trying to figure out what happens with the intramural program. So it's helpful.
Maybe I'm being too candid. I don't know how candid other people are being, but I'm one of those people. Basically, if it's the truth as I see it, and other people see it in different ways, I'll never deny that.
I got 25 after.
Okay, thank you, buddy. But so I asked Jerry, is he on his way out? If because it was obvious, I felt like I was basically put on an island, and they were flying water into it. They took all my clinical responsibilities away from me and gave me animal responsibilities, which, you know, I swallowed and took.
So you were kind of stripped of what your responsibilities that you'd had and the resources that you'd had.
Because this paper in JAMA, some people said that, you know, that it appeared that I had a conflict of interest, that I was pushing resources towards that study and taking them away from other people's. Which I never did, and I never saw those people who were complaining they're on the weekends or sleeping there at night like I did when it snowed to make sure that the studies got done the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But that was their perception. I've grown through that. It was a maturing process. It hurt at the time. But it was a maturing process. And the way I've done it now and come through life is, you know, when you're on top, when people start shooting at you, they never shoot at the guy that's on bottom. And I'd rather be on top than on bottom, no matter how many shots I'm going to get shot at me. Because if I'm doing that, I'm doing something right. I'm pushing something. And hopefully I'm pushing science forward in this case. And hopefully I'm doing the right thing.
Was it your single-minded commitment to buprenorphine in a way?
What motivated me was that. I don't think people were saying that, you know, that he's obsessed with this and that he's doing this. And, you know, and it was a perceived conflict of interest. Everybody said it was perceived. Nobody said I did it. You know, that's, and some people actually told, you know, came around, and some of my branch chief partners came around, and two of them actually told me I was getting hit with a shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always saw myself as supporting the ARC, not supporting the director, whether that be Jerry Jaffe. And I consider Jerry Jaffe a friend and a colleague, one of the most intelligent people I've ever been around. Don Jasinski is a friend and colleague. He was a director. I would have done in my view, as much for any director who was there, and I was never doing it just for the director. I was doing it for the ARC. And that was one of the things ARC had at that time, and Intramural had at that time, was a real history and a memory.
Yes.
And a commitment.
Yes.
And I think that shows through in some of the things it was able to be. And I would hope it wouldn't lose that, but it's already lost its name because it wasn't politically correct.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you lose a lot of other things when you start to lose that.
Yeah.
But for young people like myself, I mean, I was over in the library one day after I'd gone to Hopkins, and some young person was there training, was Xeroxing one of my papers. And I just facetiously said, "That's a really good paper," and they didn't know who I was.
Right.
You know, and when I talked to people who are being trained at the IRP or dictionary, what's called IRP now, and you know, some of them may not even know who Bill Martin was.
Yes,
that bothers me.
Yeah,
you know, because they're standing on the backs of giants and not recognizing it.
Yeah,
and a lot of people have done a lot of things to make sure that they're there. You know, and in some ways, that's. But anyway, I went down to the FDA. I asked to go to the FDA because I wanted to get. I asked I was assigned 3 days a week or two and a half. I think it was 3 days a week, 2 or 3 days a week to the FDA as a medical reviewer for the nicotine. I worked on the nicotine patches. But what I was doing, I knew I was going to stay in that environment forever. And I went to the VA in Washington and started doing some studies there with other people because I couldn't do my studies at the ARC. And that was the last year and a half that I was there. That's the only time I actually felt like I worked for the government.
Yeah.
Because I did think, this again, they can wait for me. I'll tell you this one story, though. Again, this is off the record.
Okay.
And I'll say this one's off the record, but you could perhaps use it if it was used in the right way.
Yes. I understand.
We were given a mandate to study adolescents. Okay, at the ARC in the 80s, right after Jaffe came there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing, we didn't know anything about adolescents, so the thing to do was to start asking questionnaires, basically. And I don't know if she was a child psychologist or what, but Jeanette Johnson was brought in as a fellow in one of the departments. And there also was a thing in the government called Paperwork Reduction Act, which means if you ask 9 or more people the same question, you have to go through the Office of Management Budget, which we often call the Valley of Shadow of Death, because you never knew when it was going to come out. And, you know, how do you get research done going, you know, like that? Now, you could get an exemption to that. We could if the study was related to a drug. But if you had a psychometric scale, there's no drug being given, they wouldn't give me an exemption, okay? So now, I always argue that everything for the intramural research program should be exempt, because the intent of Congress was that the government wouldn't go out to the private sector and burden them with things. But we weren't going out to them. They were coming to us. We were asking the questions when they come to us. That's a totally different thing. We're advertising, they're coming, they're making us, they're making, people can make a decision. The government doesn't have to make the decision for everybody. But I couldn't win that argument. So I told Jeanette, who was there for a two-year fellowship, whose career depended on her being productive while she was there, I told her, I said, after every 9 subjects, you add 1 question to your questionnaire, and I'll consider that a new questionnaire. And I never told Jerry Jaffe, because I wanted him to have what I call plausible deniability.
Sure, yes.
Now, that was something, and some people in the government didn't like me pushing the, or pulling the rubber band.
Right, but that's, I mean, that's really micromanaging, I mean, to have to...
But that's some of the things that I would do, and that was for other people. I wasn't for myself, you know, when you talk about the conflict. That's why when I was accused of conflict of interest, they made it so hard, because I knew I'd done those kind of things.
Yes.
For other people to try to make sure. And some of the people who were accusing me of that, I'd called up the, we were trying to get radio ligands in from NIH main campus to Baltimore. And I mean, none of these things were going to kill anybody if the helicopter crashed, because the half-life of them, you know, was like 30 minutes or something like that. I mean, we had to fly them directly in, and it wasn't like we were going to radiate the whole place. But one of our procurement officers made sure that one of the helicopters we were using, we actually brought them in on helicopters, didn't have the right license or something, and they'd done it forever. You know, they'd done it forever. So now then you've got a PET scanner lined up, you've got all this stuff lined up, and it's expensive to get all this stuff lined up, and you got people back here making it and all that kind of stuff. And all at once, procurement shuts me down because I can't get a helicopter to bring it in. So I get on the phone, because I figure there's an Air Force around, and these pilots have to be doing things, you know, to keep their lives. And I was in the U.S. Public Health Service, and at that time I was a lieutenant commander, and I got on the phone and I said, "This is Lieutenant Commander Johnson, and I need a plane." Those are the kind of stories they probably think I'm telling.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, and okay. Thanks for setting me up with Frank.
Okay. Is that enough for you?